Looks like perhaps four bills and 40 people. I thought we were going to have a short afternoon, but we probably won't. The chair is detained, and I will be performing his duties until he returns. We're going to go out of order to accommodate one witness today and take House Bill 3389 first. Counsel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3389 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary and provides additional means of establishing identity of controlled substance in prosecutions involving controlled substances. And I believe the two district attorneys are here with who are sponsors, who are in favor of the bill, and District Attorney Dugan from Deschutes County and District Attorney Harker Road from Lane County.
Okay, we did have a witness that had to go back.
That's
and that
right.
Was Dr. Grimsbo. Is he here?
I believe he's here, but I think he has enough time so he could go after those witnesses, and it would set probably the proper.
Is that okay, Doctor? We'll take the two district attorneys first and then take you. Okay. Mr. Harkerold, Mr. Dugan, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for having us today to present some testimony on House Bill 3389 does provide an alternative means for testing drugs, and it provides that a presumptive field test kit, which many of the police officers in the state of Oregon have, would be able to be used as evidence in the trial and for the prosecution of the person who has the drugs. I've submitted some testimony in writing. I'm not going to read that to you today. But let me say that I've been district attorney in Deschutes County since 1987. I'm accompanied today by Doug Harkelrode, who's the district attorney in Lane County. I've also been a prosecutor or criminal defense attorney since 1976. During that period of time, the presumptive field tests have been fairly often used by police officers, and most times they're used when a police officer makes a stop of a suspect, is doing an arrest or thereabouts, and does a pat down, finds small amounts of drugs. And they sometimes say, "Well, what do you got in your pocket?" And they'll say, "Oh, that's my methamphetamine, or that's my cocaine, or that's my crank, that's my speed, or whatever." And they are then subsequently put into a field test before they're sent to the state police crime lab. A test that goes to the state police crime lab costs approximately $100 to test. There are over 17,000 of these tests per year with the state police crime lab. It's my anticipation that we'll be able to establish the fact that the drug is the drug that we presume it was, and by this presumptive test, thereby being able to go forward with some of the early disposition programs that are now being discussed and operated. We'll be able to take these cases to the grand jury without waiting for the crime lab and without demanding the crime lab do tests on these small amounts of drugs, taking them away from more important things. At 17,000 tests per year, that's $1.7 million in costs. I think that as this goes along, we'll be able to save additional money. Some of the purposes of doing this would be to allow the state to proceed with a grand jury investigation and indictment without waiting for the certified crime lab. It'd be allow us to put people into the drug courts, allow us to enter into early disposition agreements, and allow us to proceed with the case while the crime lab is doing more important work in bigger and more major cases. I think that it's a really good idea. It's not 100%, and I don't think any scientist will tell you that it's 100% accurate. That's why the bill provides an opportunity for the defendant to request the test by the crime lab. We're not going to destroy the drugs once the presumptive test is performed, and we're going to allow the defendant to ask us for an official crime lab report. We think that that's reasonable. It doesn't take any rights away from the defendant, and in fact protects the defendant's rights. I would ask that your support on this, and I appreciate the committee time in allowing us to present it. I think Mr. Harkerwood has some comments as well.
Mr. Harkleroad?
Vice Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkleroad, the Lane County District Attorney, and I don't want to rehash what Mike has said. What I want to tell you is I believe this bill will save money and it will work, and here's why I believe that. For years in Lane County, we have had a drug court. One of the things we did when we set up drug court was to say, we're not going to test the drugs. If you want to get in drug court, we're not testing them. You're going to agree they're the drugs, and then you get in. And they have about 14 days, basically, to get into drug court. And they're given advice by our public defender. And routinely, over the years, defendants have entered drug court with absolutely no testing at all, although a field test might have occurred. Well, this is more protection for those people than what we're doing successfully in Lane County without any problems in our drug court. So I believe this will work just fine, and I'm confident it will save many, many thousands of dollars, which in essence what will happen is the lab will, instead of testing drugs, they will do other forensic work that we desperately need done, as Mike said. Enough said for me. Thank you.
Okay, questions of the panel by members of the committee. Evidently well done, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Call next Dr. Grimsbo.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Raymond Grimsbo. I'm a forensic scientist. I've been practicing forensic science for the past 27 years. For 9.5 years, I was a criminalist, a sworn member of the Oregon State Police, assigned to the Portland Crime Laboratory. I'm here to talk, I suppose you say, against what I consider bad science, and that is giving prima facie evidence classifications to tests that only indicate the materials that are being passed out. Talk about screening tests, confirmatory tests. Reading from one of them, a screening test refers to tests whose primary function is to eliminate some drugs from consideration, at the same time indicate but not identify which drug might be present. In the medical field, we deal with urine toxicologies. Under state law in Oregon, before I can turn out a positive urine marijuana test, I have to confirm that. I do a screening test that puts it into a classification of drugs, maybe we'll say marijuana, and under the law from the health division, I have to be able to show that I've confirmed the presence of that drug, or I can't turn it out as positive. It's going to deny somebody employment. This law is going to, I think, deny freedoms to individuals by the very fact that we're using a presumptive test, a test that is not necessarily accurate. If you would look at Marquis test as an example, we use the Marquis test, sulfuric acid and formaldehyde solution, to identify or give us an indication of which area of drugs we're dealing with. I put 2 pages from Clark's identification of drugs in the packet you received. The test changes colors. It's a simple color test, and you can look at that and see how many different shades of color. If I was to ask everybody what color this tie is, everybody would have a variation on red, more than likely. The color tests do the same thing. It tells me that maybe we have an opiate here, probably, or an amphetamine-based type drug. There's a lot of drugs, thousands of drugs, that will react with these tests. And they do consume sample. And that sample, once it's consumed, is gone. There's no record of it except what the police officer sees. As an example, the Marquis test, sulfuric acid will turn white powder brown. The Marquis test flashes orange, then turns to brown. If you miss that orange flash in 30 seconds, you've got a positive if all you're looking for is brown. It is not necessarily an objective test. It's a subjective test. And I think that the one of the problems is using these tests for anything more than an indicator. We see them all the time. The crime lab, my laboratory, uses these tests to give us an idea of where we have to go, what types of tests we need to do, and invariably it'll boil down to GCMS confirmation of the actual ingredient present.
questions of the doctor? President Barker?
Thank you. All right. On these, now there, what we just heard was that they'll use this test, and then if I'm tested positive and I say, well, that isn't what that is, I have the right to say I want that tested in the state police lab. So I think, I mean, what I see is a great savings of money and weight and a lot of time when I get stopped and I admit, yeah, that's my cocaine, instead of having to send it to the crime lab to have them say, yeah, that's cocaine, the field test, field, whatever you call it, field kit, says it's cocaine. So why not go ahead and skip that extra step? It's still there. It's preserved. If they destroy the amount of evidence to be tested again, that evidence wouldn't stand up in court.
Representative Barker, that's correct. There's two aspects to that that concern me. One is, well, first off, it doesn't concern me from the standpoint that if I do a presumptive test and it indicates cocaine and I ask the person, and this can be in a urine sample or solid dosage drug, and that individual says, yeah, it's my cocaine. It's cocaine. That is, he's confirming or she's confirming my preliminary examination. Secondly, and something concerned me even when I was with the state police, was the fact that if a defendant wants it tested under this law, it's sent to the state police crime lab. Aren't they bound by ethics to have to turn those results over to the prosecutor when, in fact, the defense attorney and the defendant has a right to have those independently analyzed where they can, and if it comes up positive, it happens to me all the time. Hey, doc, test this powder. We want to confirm what it is. And I test it, and chances are I won't be in court because it's right. So there, I think it's a double-edged sword.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Dr. Grimsboe, the written testimony from Mr. Dugan states that the tests in question are 95% accurate, with the inaccuracies being as many false negatives as false positives, and you were indicating that these are subjective tests with a lot of uncertainty about them. Is that a fair characterization of the science about these tests that we got from the district attorney?
Representative McPherson, I would I've known Mr. Dugan for a long time, and with all respect, 95% is not accurate. I would not bet on these tests anymore than I would bet on a chest x-ray and a speck on the chest x-ray for my physician to go in and say, you got to have a mastectomy today without additional testing. They are purely indicators. Their biggest benefit is to exclude everything else and give us an area that we want to look at so we don't have to waste our time doing a myriad of different tests on certain drugs.
Paula?
Yes.
Is there scientific analysis that would then peg, in your view, a lower level of reliability? Is there some number we can look to, or some sort of range of magnitude of reliability? Is it more like 50% in your view?
I couldn't say. It's going to depend upon the drug. Scott's test is very good for cocaine. Dupinoy Levine is very good for marijuana. The Marquis test, as you see in the handout, brings in everything depending upon the color change. And if my eyes don't see color the same way, I'm partially colorblind, we'll say, I'm going to misinterpret the test. And there's no going back to that specific test at the time. So it subsequently would either end up in my laboratory, and if it's an indigent case, I have a contract with the state court administrator, so the state of Oregon would pay for me to test it, or on the other hand, the state police are going to be paid to test it. Okay, one way or the other, it'll be tested.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? If not, thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Next witness, Kelly Sky.
Vice Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Sky, and I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And our organization opposes this bill. We oppose it primarily because we don't see it as being fair to criminal defendants. In a sense, it shifts the burden to the defendant. It asks the defendant to either admit that a scientifically unreliable test is accurate, or to request, make that affirmative step of requesting that a confirmatory test be done, and then requires them to pay the cost of that test should it confirm the field test results. So ordinarily, a criminal defendant is entitled to a trial and is entitled to have the state prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. This statute would somewhat shift the burden. You are no longer entitled to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. You're entitled to presumptive proof or field test proof, and if you want proof beyond a reasonable doubt, you'll have to pay for that. There are other uses of this test that that lead us to concern. Because it's a field test, it can be used in the field. You can see where the power of science. We all, if a police officer or a scientist were to bring this field test in and were to test a controlled substance here in front of us and to say, oh, you know, this turned pink and that means it's cocaine, the power of science is recognized by the courts as highly influential. So you can see that out in the field, if a police officer is doing a field test, that they're then going to be able to say, well, this turns pink, then that means it's cocaine, so you need to admit to me that it's cocaine, or isn't it cocaine? And it can be used in a way to obtain confessions that would otherwise not be obtained and possibly be illegal. The circumstances of the use of this test that have been presented here, primarily people have talked about the use of this test in cases where there are confessions, but frequently, and there are usually, you know, there are frequently confessions, and those confessions admittedly could support a conviction alone without the crime lab report, but not all cases have a confession, and so those cases are the cases that we are more concerned about. In terms of allowing the district attorney's office to be able to do early disposition agreements and diversion programs, as Mr. Harkleroad stated, the way that the law is written right now, the district attorney's office is fully open to pursuing those agreements. There's nothing about this statute that will change their ability to do that. We are concerned that this evidence is not scientifically reliable under Oregon law. And I believe that this committee heard testimony on another bill during the tort reform set of bills that sought to tighten the definition of scientific evidence. And that would apply here in criminal law as well. But the courts have addressed the definition of scientific evidence and the admissibility of scientific evidence. And what they talk about is the courts have to determine whether something is relevant, clearly this would be relevant, and whether it's reliable. And they look at a number of things. They look at the general acceptance of the technique in the field. And you heard from Dr. Grinspoon, and I think you're going to hear from the state crime lab, that these field tests are not generally accepted in the field as scientifically reliable as confirmation of the existence of a controlled substance. The courts also look to the current use of the technique. Well, the current use of the technique, as you heard from Dr. Grimsboe, and you'll most likely hear from the state crime lab, is as a screening test. It's not used as a confirmatory test, and confirmatory tests are always used before a lab report is written as positive for a controlled substance. They also look at the potential rate for error. Clearly, the reason that these tests are used as screening tests is that they do have a higher potential rate of error. And labeling someone as a convicted felon for possession of a controlled substance, as you know, can have a significant impact on their life. It affects their employment. It may affect their housing, not to mention their actual liberty, as they might go to jail. The courts also look at the extent to which a particular scientific technique relies on the subjective interpretation of the, quote, expert. These field tests are anticipated to be done, in many cases, by police officers in the field who are trained by the state crime lab. And as Dr. Grimsboe explained to you, many of these tests, the interpretation of them is based on different shades, different colors that a drug may turn when exposed to different agents. And some of them actually change more than one color. So it may go orange to brown or violet to red. And I think that there is a document in what Mr. Grimsboe provided to you that explains that. This allows for a great deal of subjective interpretation. Police officers in the field are not in a position, or they're not in the controlled environment of a crime lab to be making these kind of calls, and there is nothing that is preserved from that field test kit that can be shown in court as evidence of the result of the test, because with time those colors will fade. So it's not as though the officer can take the stand and say, here's the test that I did to show that this is a controlled substance. They won't have that to come in, because as time goes, the colors will fade. And so you'll end up, at least for cases going to trial, maybe the state will go ahead and have the evidence tested at the crime lab, which arguably they don't have to do, and I don't believe that they would do in all cases. It's likely that a good criminal defense lawyer is going to advise somebody charged with possession of a controlled substance using one of these field tests. They're going to advise them to get an independent test. The Supreme Court has recognized a due process right to the assistance of an expert where it is needed. And if we have, in controlled substance cases, police officers or forensic scientists coming in and testifying about the use of a field test, then the defendant is going to have a due process right to have an independent expert come in and testify about the reliability of those tests. Or the defense attorney may advise them to send it out to a private lab for a private confirmatory test. So in terms of saving money, it may end up being a cost-shifting issue. The crime lab may save some money in not doing those confirmatory tests, but indigent expense is going to be required under the Constitution to make sure that that gets paid for. So it's for those reasons that we disagree with this bill. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Ms. Skye. Are there questions for Ms. Skye, Representative Barker?
Thank you. Ms. Skye, you said the defendant would have to pay for it, but they wouldn't have to if it's negative. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then you said they'd say, well, look, it's pink. That looks like cocaine. And I mean, that's what they say today anyway. So I don't see a change. And then if I'm carrying aspirin, I powder it and snort it because I don't like the taste or something, you know, I would, and it somehow falsely showed positive, I'd ask to have it tested. I mean, I don't think this is an unreasonable or unconstitutional thing to me. It seems like this would save some money for the state, and at the same time, the defendant would be protected. Their constitutional rights would be protected. They have all the rights they have today, except that we're not going to take an extra step to have a test. If the person says, yeah, it's cocaine, I admit it's cocaine, and let's go. And I mean,
Representative Barker, I think that the point I was trying to make there is the courts have repeatedly recognized the strength of scientific evidence, in that if someone says this is science and this is going to tell me what this controlled substance is, it may be that the person who's possessing it doesn't really know. Half the time, people don't know whether what they possess is a controlled substance or bunk. They may think it's bunk and it's really a controlled substance. But the idea behind the court limiting the admissibility of scientific evidence is the power of science, the power of having a little kit that supposedly tells someone exactly what a certain substance is. And that's why the courts have narrowed the admissibility of scientific evidence, because they know that the jury is very susceptible to believing something merely because it's science. And that same influence takes place in the field when a police officer uses a scientific kit and then questions a defendant. Granted, a lot of this is probably done in the field now, but this seeks to make it routine, and it also seeks to not require a confirmatory test afterwards. And the person in the field who says, no, I don't agree with you, that's not what it is, it may require them to be incarcerated for a longer period of time before they can meet with their attorney and make the affirmative step of requesting a confirmatory test. And it also may end up in people pleading guilty merely just to get out of the criminal justice system, as you well know happens. People plead guilty to get out of jail. And if there is an unreliable field test in place that the officer says, well, this is, it's cocaine, a person is much more likely to believe that because it's science than they are to wait and have a confirmatory test.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have difficulty. I mean, if I'm packing cocaine, I know it's cocaine, or I think it is. I mean, I don't agree with you that it's common that people will say, I'm guilty of drugs because they want to get out of the criminal justice system. I don't think that happens. At least that hasn't been my experience. I mean, people that are caught with drugs plead guilty sometimes. People who are caught without drugs don't. And so I would disagree with you on that respect.
Further questions from Ms. Skye, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Skye, I'm just curious. A thought kind of popped into my mind that I can imagine the conversations that the legislature had when the breathalyzer first came out and was being utilized in the field by law enforcement. So help me understand something, and that is how different is this than the breathalyzer?
Well, I'm not a scientist, and I'm no expert in the breathalyzer, Representative Crummell, but the differences that I would point out are that the breathalyzer is a unit that is routinely maintained and calibrated. There are records kept on the maintenance and calibration. It produces a result which is admissible in court as evidence. It shows exactly what the result of that test. There's no subjective interpretation of a breathalyzer. There are intoxilizer or breathalyzer units that are field units that are used in the field, and those units generally are not admissible in court as they are determined to be less reliable. There, for instance, there is a mini breathalyzer that's close in size to a pen that can be shown into someone's mouth and would probably serve as a good screening test for whether you have alcohol in your breath, but would it be admissible in court? No, because it's not scientifically reliable as, say, the breathalyzer, which is a machine that has been presented with science and deemed admissible in a court of law. But the people from the State Crime Lab might be able to answer that question better than I.
Further questions from Ms. Skye, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To your knowledge, in relationship to the tests that are being referred to here, do you have knowledge to the reliability? 90%, 95%, 50%? Is there any? Are these tests quantified someplace, the reliability quantified someplace, to your knowledge?
Representative Jensen, no, not to my knowledge, and my knowledge would come from Dr. Grimsboe, who testified before me.
Okay. And one of the things that bothers me, Mr. Chair, I don't know whether all of the officers that are going to be using this are going to be female, or whether the males are going to be tested for colorblindness.
Representative Jensen, I truly appreciate your point. And that is part of the issue of the subjective interpretation of the results. And no, that issue is not addressed here in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anybody else? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Skye, in the case where a request for a test done by the state lab is made and then it comes back positive, so that it's confirming the presumptive test, and on whom does that charge fall? Is that a cost of the indigent defense, so that if we're an indigent defendant, it would be paid for then through that system, or is it something where the defendant is expected to advance those funds? What happens to that charge?
The way the bill's written here?
Well, I'm trying to relate it to the sort of the administration of criminal defense generally.
And I, Representative McPherson, I understand what you're saying, and the way that this bill is written, I believe that after the confirmatory results confirmed a positive test, and after the person was subsequently convicted, the court would order them to repay the cost of having that tested. That would be an order that the defendant repay that. Now, if the defendant didn't have the money to repay that, there is some ability of the court to take ability to pay into consideration. And they may or may not order the defendant. Currently, a defendant can be required by the court to repay costs that are provided from indigent expense. Say, for instance, the experts that you've heard about. If indigent expense pays for an expert for the defendant, at the close of the case, if they are convicted, they can be ordered to repay indigent expense for that amount. And this would be treated similar to that. It wouldn't be that the state crime lab would then bill indigent expense for the test, is my understanding. It would be an expense of the defendant. So if the defendant had money, they would have to pay it. If the defendant didn't have money, the court could take that into consideration or may impose it, and it would later become a civil judgment.
Mr. Chair, if I could. So what I think I'm hearing is that there's no need for the defendant to advance the funds. It is only upon conviction that this would become an obligation of the defendant. So I'm trying to measure whether or not there would be any deterrent in a defendant who might be deterred from challenging a presumptive test because of financial considerations. That's really what I'm getting at.
Representative McPherson, you're right. The way I read the bill, they would not be required to advance it, and it would only be assessed upon conviction. Probably not the possibility of having that cost assessed is probably not going to be a big deterrent to most criminal defendants. The bigger problem I see there is the time spent incarcerated on an offense. And depending on the times, right now people aren't spending any time in jail on possession of a controlled substance because we're not appointing counsel and they can't hold them in jail. But were at a time when we were appointing counsel and they could be held in jail, they would sit in jail waiting for this confirmatory test to take place, whereas now the tests in Multnomah County and Lane County, those tests are finished by the time of grand jury. So the person is held until grand jury, and then that test has already been finished.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Dunn. I think our last witnesses are Emma Dutton and Linton Von, and I'm going to mess up the last name, Beroldingen. What did I do? Beroldingen. You can tell us how you say it. Whichever one of you would like to start is fine.
I'm Dr. Emma Dutton from the Oregon State Police Forensic Crime Lab. I'm the Quality Assurance Manager for the laboratories, and this is Mr. Linton von Beroldinger.
For the record, ladies and gentlemen, the last name is Beroldingen. You may address me as Linton. That would be fine.
Say it one more time.
Beroldingen.
Beroldingen. All right.
I handed out our testimony as well as some information on the color test or the presumptive test that are being discussed today. And I also brought a package of what these NIC kits or these tests look like. If you're interested in seeing what the field test looks like.
We had a little abbreviated lunch hour. Otherwise, I'd make some of my colleagues here take it, but we won't do that on the record.
So these are the field tests, and there's just a little pouch, and there's a little ampule in there, and you would put the controlled substance in the pouch, break the ampule, mix it up, and look for a color change. And there were a couple of tests that we did prior to coming over, and some of them are already expired in color. One of them still looks okay. So I'll just pass this around if you want to take a look at this as well. And hand that over.
Could you just tell us when those tests were actually done so we know as we look at it?
We did those about 12:30. Those two tests were for amphetamine or methamphetamine, and the other one was for tar, heroin. So if you want to let me, if you could hand those to me. So Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division has taken a neutral position on this bill. We use color test as our presumptive test in the laboratory and follow those tests up with a confirmatory test. As was previously discussed, a presumptive test just provides grounds of reasonable opinion where you could say that a drug is possibly present or not present. These tests are not confirmatory and they're not conclusive. In the laboratory, we do a presumptive test. We always follow those presumptive tests up with a confirmatory test. From those tests, the presumptive and the confirmatory test, then we draw conclusions and write a report and submit the report as to the controlled substance present or not present. The NIC kits are presumptive field tests. The kits are available to test all commonly abused drugs, cocaine, marijuana, heroin, methamphetamine, amphetamine, LSD, etc. There are, however, non-controlled substances that could provide false positive results, and in addition, you could get false negative results. That is, you might see a powder that looks like methamphetamine, test it, and it could come up false negative. There's that potential. The fiscal impact for the Forensic Services Division certainly would be positive. That is, if we had a reduction in the number of confirmatory tests or a reduction in the number of requests that we were doing on an annual basis, then those resources that were performing those tests could be moved into other areas of the laboratory and support other disciplines or do other discipline tests. If you have any questions about the NIC kit or the science behind the kit, Linton can certainly answer those questions for you.
Linton, do you have anything to add, or are you here just to respond to questions?
I'd just like to point out that what you observe now in those test kits is no longer readable. The test kits for various types of controlled substances utilize different types of chemistry, but the particular kit that you're working with there contains a reagent that is based on sulfuric acid, and anything organic sitting in there long enough will char and turn brown. So the interpretation of that kit was something that we could make within half a minute to a couple of minutes of running that test, and after 10 to 15 minutes had gone by, it was no longer something that we would attempt to interpret. And I would like to add that there is no really solid numerical data that we can offer you about the reliability of these tests in general. Again, they are largely based in empirical chemistry that has come down over the span of 100 years, and certain things that these tests do we consider to be very strong indicators of the presence of a controlled substance. For example, Dr. Grimsbo mentioned, I think he said, Scott's test. When that test is positive, there are two layers, like oil and water in a test tube, and the top is pink and the bottom is a bright blue. And I have not seen in my career of since 1975 of doing forensic chemistry an indication where that test has been positive and I have failed to detect cocaine in subsequent confirmatory tests. But having said that, I'll reiterate what Dr. Dutton just said, which is that in forensic laboratories in the United States, a color test by itself is not relied upon for the purpose of reporting the identification of a controlled substance.
Other questions? Representative Ackerman.
Maybe I missed this. I was trying to read the materials, and on the fourth numbered paragraph of your presentation, you indicate that there's some non-controlled substances which would indicate a false positive. What would be some of the more common non-controlled substances that would yield that result?
Representative Ackerman, there are, for example, a number of compounds who have structural similarity with methamphetamine or amphetamine, which will react with the reagent to produce a similar orange color. But having said that, in the context of day-to-day work in the crime lab, those are not frequently observed, but they do occur. There is a
drug substance which is not controlled, which is present in over-the-counter medications. It has a kind of funny name, guaifenesin or guaifenesin. And that material in contact with the reagent, which gives a bright purple color with heroin, will also produce a bright purple color. And the fundamental basis for many of these test reagents is that the reagent identifies a particular type of structure, which is a portion of a molecule. And the reaction that is observed is consistent with the presence of that kind of structure. But it does not tell you the whole structure of the whole molecule, which is its identity, which is what we do in the confirmatory phase. Again, interpretation of any scientific test result is in the context of the analysis, and we do not see the entire spectrum of chemicals in the world. We see a continuing flow of certain primary substances which are abused by persons in our society. So when working in the laboratory, I see positive presumptive tests arising from the initial analysis of a substance whose form and packaging strongly suggests to me that it is a controlled substance, and those test results are also indicative of that. I have a very high expectation of being able to confirm that result.
Questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you. So in the field, when if an officer, state trooper, takes some powder from somebody, puts it in there, gets a showing that it isn't illegal contraband, then they let the person go, or what do they do?
I can't answer that question because I don't know what they're trained to do at that stage, but what I would expect is that they would probably conclude that they did not have a controlled substance, and the officer could decide at that point whether to submit it to the laboratory for further investigation or not. To briefly address that issue, the possibility exists of false negatives in a practical sense with a well-trained officer who has experience and recognizes the street dosage forms of drugs. The likelihood of a false positive is going to be somewhat low, but of the things that come through the laboratory, which I suspect in many cases have not been field tested, the one thing we see with some frequency, which is not what it seems, is crack cocaine. Little lumps of off-white waxy material that are sometimes soap, sometimes a piece of rock, sometimes a waxy substance, sometimes something made out of acetaminophen or Tylenol. But none of those things give that brilliant positive pink over blue test.
Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I assume from your testimony about a half a minute to 2 minutes time element that it's important for the officer not to be in the field test, not to be distracted for any reason, in order to have any good reliability of the test that he's just done.
The best circumstances for conducting this kind of test would be when one was not distracted, when one had had experience of seeing positives and negatives in a training program, and where one had good lighting under which to observe the reaction.
Anything else? Okay, thank you both very much. We appreciate your testimony. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3389. And we're going to move back up to the top of our agenda and open a public hearing on House Bill 2672. And I'd like to call Victor Hopper to come forward, if you would, please.
For the record, my name is Victor Hopper, H-O-F-F-E-R. I live in Mount Angel, Oregon. Chairman Williams and members of the committee, I'd like to thank particularly Representative Zahner and his staff, Nicole and Matt, for assisting me in this journey through a house bill. It's been very interesting and very painful, and I certainly look forward to never being a lobbyist, but being just a citizen. I'd like to thank you for taking the time to discuss House Bill 2672. The goal of House Bill 2672 is simple. It is to protect the elderly. In Oregon, elder abuse is the physical, emotional, sexual, or financial abuse or neglect of a person 65 years of age or older when the perpetrator knows the victim's age and targets him or her because of it. Because of the decreased public dollars that we have in Oregon at this time, there are less checks and balances to protect seniors and to check on the elderly. I have a paper, and you have copies of this, from the Oregonian discussing social services and the ability to recognize and protect. I would first like to give you a little bit of history. Most paramedics, EMTs, emergency medical technicians, and firefighters believe that they are already mandatory reporters of elder abuse. That is because there is a statute on the books, ORS 124.050. But we are not mandatory reporters. We believe, as we are already mandatory reporters of child abuse, we are of elder abuse. This is incorrect. What this bill does is provide five words, firefighter or emergency medical technician, to the present statute, thereby making firefighters and emergency medical technicians mandatory reporters. By adding these five words, it is our hope that we will continue to do what we do now, which is protect the elderly. What does the five words mean? It makes firefighters and emergency medical technicians mandatory reporters. And as I have said, this mirrors the five words in the child abuse statute. We hope that this will provide heightened awareness to all providers of medical and fire services in the community. In addition, it also provides under 124.075 immunity to firefighters and emergency medical technicians for good faith reporting. And we also have a statement from Legislative Council confirming that belief. There are some concerns, however, and I'd like to address those briefly. First, there is a concern that we are already reporting, and we don't need this bill, these five words. However, I believe it is best that we add these for two reasons. It increases heightened awareness of the problems there in the community, and two, it provides immunity under 124.075. All reporters that provide good faith reporting will receive immunity from the reporting. Now, the goal of this bill is to provide protection to the elderly. And firefighters and emergency medical technicians are often the first on scenes of calls where people, children, and in this case, the elderly may need protection. But there is a concern there as well. Will there be a chilling effect to people calling for help? I can only tell you in my personal experience as a paramedic with Metro West Ambulance in Washington County, Tigard, Beaverton, and Hillsborough, and as a firefighter and emergency medical technician with Mount Angel Fire Department and a 20-year member of the Mount Angel Ambulance, that I have not seen this happen with child abuse. People call for help, and we respond. When people call 911, they know that they will get a response. And firefighters and EMTs are the first ones there. And we all certainly believe that they should report. As I want to make clear, my observation is that there won't be a chilling effect from the 20 years plus of experience that I've had. In addition, there's a question about a need for education. Many firefighters and emergency medical technicians already report, and many of us are educated and understand that we should report. But not all fire departments and ambulance companies have the same opportunities for education. And I do know that I've talked to the coordinator for protective services with the Department of Human Services, and she has told me that that agency is willing and ready to provide training and assistance to smaller departments and smaller agencies. Finally, a concern about underreporting. Again, we'd have to look at history of child abuse. There have been some lawsuits filed against people who have not reported child abuse. Generally speaking, these would be are mostly teachers, and I believe on occasion attorneys. Again, I'm pulling from experience that if a child comes to a teacher, a firefighter, or emergency medical technician, attorney, or other mandatory reporters and says, I am being abused, one has a clear mandatory requirement to report. But at the same time, we see things every day and we use our common sense and good judgment to decide if this is a reportable action. Just recently, I cared for someone in Beaverton. The woman that I was caring for looked emaciated to me. She was in a nursing home. Her son arrived, and I found out this is her normal condition for the last 90 years of her life. To me, she looked very thin. To the family, she was, in fact, normal. So it's a matter of perspective. And I believe that firefighters and emergency medical technicians do not have cause to worry about lawsuits based on our experience with child abuse. I would like to say that if there are questions about this bill, I'm willing to work with anyone to find answers and work committees or whatever would be necessary to assure its passage. I must say that the most important reason for adding these five words is to protect senior citizens, the elderly. The byproduct is immunity for good faith reporting. It seems important and logical to provide protection to the elderly. It's logical to clear up the statute that most of us believe that those words already exist. And members of the committee, it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Victor. Are there questions for Mr. Hoffer, Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question is not really a question, it's just a comment that I would be remiss if I didn't suggest that legislators in this bill should be included, as I did when we were talking about child abuse.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
You know, we are. If you look in the definition, I looked at that too.
Okay.
If you look in the definition of public or private official, it includes any in the catch-all, sub K on lines 7 and 8 on page 2, any public official who comes in contact with elderly persons in the performance of the official's official duties. And I would assume that includes us. So we're on call.
Thank you.
At least any of us on this committee, because of both your presence, Representative, and Representative Ackerman, who turned 66 today.
We're vulnerable people. We appreciate the protection of our colleagues in a bipartisan sense.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, thank you. Mr. Hoffer did raise the sort of the quid pro quo. That's the double-edged sword, I guess, of getting brought into this statute for immunity purposes. You get the immunity for a good faith report, but it does come with once getting listed in that itemization of mandatory reporters, the exposure to civil liability for failing to report when you should have reported. And so often, the risk, as we know, so often that's going to be a judgment that somebody else is going to make months or even longer than that after the fact, when circumstances are, may not be entirely as they were when the decision is made. And I would just point that out to the advocates for this thing. That is a double-edged sword here. To get that grant of immunity for the good faith report, it does carry with it the risk of civil liability for failing to report. And I think, again, what we know from the child abuse statute, once you're on this list of mandatory reporters, I think you're on duty 24 hours a day, and not just when you come into somebody on in the context of performance of your job duties. So there's a burden as well as a benefit that comes with this.
That's right. There are additional questions. Thank you, Victor.
Chairman Williams?
Yes.
Representative Shalali, I think your statements are very, very well spoken, and I would have to admit at this time that I'm an attorney, and I know that under child abuse, there is discussion whether we are on duty 24/7 as an attorney under child abuse, and I happen to believe that we are as well. And the opportunity to have immunity is important, but the greater good and the greater goal is to provide protection to the elderly. I'd like to thank you, Chairman Williams, to have the pleasure to come before you personally and to the members of the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Holzer. Why don't we bring up now Sean Baird and Jacqueline Zimmer-Jones. Is Jacqueline here, or did she have to step out?
She had to step out, Chair.
Okay, we will note on the record, because that's the box that she checked, that Jacqueline Zimmer-Jones and the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging, which is a mouthful in and of itself, are in support of the bill. Mr. Baird.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Sean Baird. I'm a paramedic and the owner of Woodburn Ambulance Service, and I'm currently the president of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. I think they're passing out some testimony from our association. I just wanted to say that our members think that this is an appropriate thing for paramedics and EMTs to be doing, and we feel that it's appropriate also to be on the mandatory reporting scheme. And I'd be happy to take any questions from you.
Thank you, Mr. Baird. The questions for Mr. Baird. Representative Chetterill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a question, but maybe clarification of my last comments. Council has pointed out this, and I'd forgotten this statute does differ from the child abuse in that it does limit the mandatory reporting to persons with whom the mandatory reporters come into contact while acting in an official capacity. So this is not a 24/7 obligation as it is under the child abuse reporting. So I want to get that clear in case anybody is listening.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And now if I could have Bob Livingston, Ken Armstrong, and Genoa Ingram come forward. Do you want to start, Bob?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I will. My name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And briefly, I would just like to make a couple of points with respect to House Bill 2672. However, before I do that, I think that I could speak for all three of us here, in that one of the foundations of the fire service is to make sure that at all times that we're doing what's appropriate to protect the citizens of all the Oregonians and all people that we come in contact, and particularly that would echo for some of our more vulnerable populations, including young children as well as some of our seniors. However, having said that, I think, as Mr. Hoffer noted, there are some concerns that I share as well as I do in conversations with Mr. Armstrong. And one of the first and foremost concerns that we have with this bill, although we believe with the overall issues regarding this bill, is one of training. As you know, over the years, we've continued to have more and more issues put into the fire service, and at some point in time, we believe that when you're going to pass legislation like this, there needs to be training that goes with it. Granted, some of the larger agencies may have the amount of and the resources and abilities to deal with a new piece of legislation like this, but many of our rural departments, combination departments, simply don't have the training or the knowledge to make sure that the training is there so that really you do have good policy put in place. And so one of the concerns I think that we do anytime that you could have some mandatory piece of legislation be presented is making sure that mechanism is in place to provide good training. And certainly with elder abuses, Mr. Hoffer noted, clearly it's not only just for physical and obvious signs that I think personally we're already doing a fairly good job of reporting, but that issue of financial and some of those other things that certainly I would not be sure whether from a financial standpoint whether I would know what that is or not. And so I think that it's very important that training be part in that, particularly in light of what Representative Shetterly said with that double-edged sword. The final issue before I turn it over to Mr. Armstrong that I'd like to make is that, as noted by Mr. Hoffer, one of the questions that I have, and I certainly don't have the answer to this, as a practitioner and someone that who has actually experienced this in a life situation, one of my questions that I have is, are we creating more of a problem than trying to find a solution to an answer here? And what I mean by that is, Do we run the risk of having firefighters and first responders, because they're mandatory reporters, be put in a place to where somebody that's in a foster care situation or someone that's taking care of their elders now take a pause and not necessarily call 911 for the emergency care that some seniors may need? And I certainly don't have the answer to that, but it's something that I would like to have the answer to, on whether we're doing more harm than good with this bill in light of the fact that I think currently we are doing a fairly good job of trying to catch those situations that were kind of throw those red flags up that some of the people have already mentioned. So with that, I just want to echo that we do support wholeheartedly the fact that the fire service does take the responsibility of making sure that we protect all citizens, and particularly seniors, to the best of our ability. But with that, the responsibility needs to come additional training, and would certainly like to know if those questions that I've posed to you are legitimate or not, and I simply don't know the answer to that. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions unless the chair would like my
Why don't we have the other two members of the panel testify, and then we'll open up the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. I suppose we're in something of an awkward position here this afternoon. There's no question that the bill is well-intentioned, that it's a direction in which all the fire service certainly supports, ensuring that when abuse occurs, when it's evident that it has occurred, that we take whatever steps are necessary to protect the public. We're concerned with the very issue that Representative Shetterly represented, and that was that this can be something of a double-edged sword. There's some ambivalence on this issue when we talk about it at the Joint Fire Service Legislative Committee. You know, people can kind of see both sides. We have not signed up in opposition to the bill. We're neutral. We just simply have some concerns. As Bob said, we do everything that we can to report when we see something that looks like it's a problem situation. I think you'll find that the fire service, emergency response personnel, are very aggressive about taking what they perceive as being the right steps here to protect members of the public. Is this the right way to go? That's a difficult call to make. We're neutral on it, but I did want to raise a couple of those issues that we've been somewhat concerned about.
Thank you. Genoa?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Genoa Ingram, representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association and the Special Districts Association. I'll be brief because all three of my concerns have been mentioned previously. I'd just like to point out, with regard to Representative Shetterly's comments regarding liability, I went back and looked at the statutes, and yes, there is that relief of liability if they report in good faith, but again, there is no relief of liability if they fail to recognize that there is abuse going on. And I would just like to point out, for the most part, firefighters in Oregon are volunteers, and they are serving without compensation. We feel that they would be opening themselves up to a great deal of liability if they were put into this particular statute, and we feel that where the volunteers are concerned, given that it is difficult to attract and retain volunteers currently, that the less liability we place on them, the better. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, General. Are there questions for the panel? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, does DPSST, the training, state training system, they still go around the state and provide training to the smaller? I know that they used to do that with the smaller police departments. They'd come out and have annual training where they could be able to train so people would get the training.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that's a good question. Yes, DPSST does still assist some of the rural departments with training. However, having said that, as you know, with budgets the way they are, there is a question whether that training will even exist after June. And while there's a huge need for training, I would say that there's really not enough training that goes on or time, and that while they potentially could be able to do that, it's highly unlikely whether that would be the best mechanism to get that training to all fire service professionals.
Mr. Chair, if I almost might follow up on that. Representative Barker, I think it's fair to say that the training that goes on the police side through DPSST is considerably higher than through the fire side. So what you may have observed on the police side, that's definitely a larger component of what they do than on the fire side.
And a follow-up.
You may follow up.
And then, Mr. Livingston, I'm sorry, Mr. Armstrong, when we talk about the liability, then that would really fall back on the departments and would it not, under the doctrine of negligent training, that the people, if they're not trained adequately, then the liability would then shift back to the cities or whatever. I mean, I know a large department like Tualatin Valley would probably have adequate training, but I understand you're talking about primarily the smaller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I think that's exactly right. TVFNR in Representative Crumbles' district, they're not going to have a lot of those issues. But smaller departments, primarily the volunteer departments, as Ms. Ingram has suggested, that's where a lot of the problems would occur. Exactly right. Districts and cities.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll now close the public hearing on House Bill 2672. We're going to go to a public hearing on House Bill 2900, and I'm in that public hearing right now. Ms. Phillips and the Pratts, if you'd come forward, please. And Representative Barker, you're signed up to testify on this as well. Do you want to pull up a fourth chair and be on this first panel? Okay. Are you ready, Don?
We are. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Don Phillips. I'm Chief of Staff for State Representative Randy Miller from District 37. And the representative expresses his regrets for not being here today, but I think a lot of the heavy lifting, as you'll see on this bill, really rests with Ann and Bruce Pratt, who are here today to guide us through this presentation on House Bills 2900 and 2901, which will come after that. Just for your information, if you open your bill file, you'll see House Bill 2900. That is, in fact, not your bill that you're going to be looking at today. We are proposing a gut and stuff of our very own bill because some legislative assistant filed the wrong bill, and I won't say her name out loud. The bill that we're gutting and stuffing it with is very similar. It is no longer an administrative fee that's handled by DMV. It is instead a traffic offense. A $500 to $1,000 maximum for refusal to blow on the breathalyzer. Pretty simple. And these should be the dash two amendments that you'll be looking at. Should be six pages altogether. And the last page has an added incentive in there to earmark the funding to the state police for DUII enforcement programs. And you will be hearing from some of the folks at the state police a little bit later on. And I'd like to turn it over to Ann and Bruce Pratt from Springfield because they're really the driving force behind this, and I will stick around if you have any questions for me later.
Okay.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I reside in Lane County. And first of all, I'd like to wish you a happy birthday, Representative Ackerman. I'm just a young fellow next to you.
You said happy birthday, Bob.
Oh, thank you.
My birthday's not till tomorrow, my 66th birthday, so.
Yeah, I miss it by one day. Some people don't recognize that.
As you know, driving under the influence of intoxicants is a huge problem in Oregon. In 2002, there were over 10,000 DUI convictions posted and an additional 12,000 diversion agreements for drunk driving. There were about 200 deaths caused by drinking drivers, as well as 2,000 injuries. One in every 140 miles driven in Oregon is by a person with a blood alcohol content of 0.08 or higher. And you and I have to share the road with these people. Driving on our roads is a privilege and not a right. People who drink and drive are breaking the law and killing and injuring legally licensed and sober drivers, their passengers, and pedestrians. We are asking for laws that will stop illegal driving in order to prevent death and injury. At times when these drivers are stopped for probable cause, they refuse the field sobriety test, and after they are arrested, they refuse to blow the breath test. In these cases, the arresting officer has to rely on other methods to prove his case. At the present time, the first offense for refusal to blow results in a one-year license suspension. I believe that the breathalyzer test is a non-invasive method of measuring the presence of alcohol and the percent of alcohol in the person's system. We are proposing this fine of $500 to $1,000 for refusal of the breathalyzer test. There were in 2002, there were almost 3,000 refusals. Some of them were then convicted for DUI. Our research has found 10 other states that issue fines for refusal, and you'll find that list in that presentation. With a fine of $500 to $1,000 for refusal of the breath test, the offender will need to consider his answer. A continued refusal would indicate that the offender had something to hide. This refusal evidence is admissible at trial under a DUI hearing. In conclusion, driving under the influence of intoxicants is the most often committed violent crime in Oregon. We need to continue to close the loopholes that allow drinking drivers to evade the laws of our state and threaten the legal and sober drivers and their passengers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt. Ms. Pratt?
Chair Williams and members of the committee, I'm Ann Pratt, and I'm from Lane County. I'm a member of Crime Victims United, Parents of Murdered Children, and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I'm also the mother of a drunk driving victim. A man with a 0.19 blood alcohol content killed my youngest son in 1998. First of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm here to ask you to pass House Bill 2900, which is adding the fine of $500 to $1,000 for refusal of the breathalyzer. I believe we all need to abide by the laws of the state of Oregon, not just some of us. Each year, there are approximately those 3,000 offenders who refuse to submit to the breathalyzer test when asked to do so by law enforcement. The implied consent law of our state enables that officer to ask that motorist to submit under probable cause. If I were stopped and I had been drinking, I can think of only one reason I would refuse to blow. I might be found guilty of being legally intoxicated, guilty of DUII if I blew a .08 or over. Or possibly I had been down this road before and I knew the procedure. Or possibly I had been advised not to blow. I am told that prosecutors can and do prosecute these offenders, but refusals are harder to prove and very time-consuming. Time equates to dollars in our court system. I brought with me a prime example of the type of person who refuses. I would like to tell you briefly about a man. His name is Buffalo Zobel, and he's from West Lynn. I do have written testimony from Mr. Zobel that I would like to submit instead of my written testimony. it is also combined with a newspaper story that was written approximately a year or so ago about him. Buffalo Zobel was a runner who was training for the Portland Marathon in 2000 when he was struck down by a car driven by an intoxicated Timothy Zoldani. So Zoldani already had a fairly lengthy history of DUI offenses. In 1996, he had a DUI conviction after driving through the yards of three houses. He was sentenced to 2 days in jail and ordered to drug and alcohol treatment program. His blood alcohol content was 0.14. In 2000, he was cited on February 5th, again for DUI. His blood alcohol content was 0.12. He was cited again in March, and he refused the breathalyzer. Those cases were pending when on June 24th at 7:15 in the morning, Soldani ran down Mr. Zobel after a night of drinking with friends. This is a quote from Mr. Zobel's testimony. In my case, he was apprehended in Lake Oswego shortly after he hit me, but he refused a breathalyzer test at the scene. It was 3 hours later before he was forced to give a blood sample for BAC. It was 0.13. It was estimated at the time of impact it was at least 0.17. So this man refused twice. Mr. Zobel lived, but has endured at least 15 operations since June of 2000. Spent 9 months in a wheelchair and has had to learn to walk again. Soldani was sentenced to 8 years, 3 months in prison for assault, 2 felony hit and run, among other convictions, and driving with a suspended license. I spoke with Mr. Zobel last week. Although he hopes to be a marathon runner again, he is grateful he can even walk. This is what happened to him that night. The hit-and-run crash broke both his legs, fractured a bone in his lower back, separated his right shoulder, left him with severe facial injuries, which required skin grafts and plastic surgery. He was wearing reflective jogging gear, running against traffic, and was off the roadway. And the driver actually had to drive across the double yellow line. Please read Mr. Zobel's story. He says, it's a miracle that I am alive. He also says, I believe the system failed in this case. We must strengthen our laws to prevent first-time and repeat offenders from striking again. The purpose of House Bill 29 is very simple. It's about getting at the truth by prompting the DUI offenders to blow and identifying them and getting them off our roadways. It's about reducing the threat of the hundreds of intoxicated drivers who are using our roadways on a daily basis. We need all the tools and resources possible to get them off our roads. The added bonus of this bill is the extra revenue. We have requested it be designated to the Oregon State Police DUI Enforcement Program. And I also want to add that Crime Victims United, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and Parents of Murdered Children support this bill. House Bill 2900 is about responsibility, accountability, public safety. Please pass House Bill 2900. Thank you, Chair Williams and members. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mrs. Pratt. We appreciate your testimony. Why don't we go ahead and have Representative Barker speak, and we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jeff Barker, Representative Jeff Barker, House District 28. I'm a strong supporter of this bill in that I've seen people refuse the breath test frequently when they're drunk or when, especially when they're a repeat offender and they've been through the system. This puts people on notice that Oregon's serious about the breath test, and I think it would deter people from drinking and driving. And that's the hope here. Not catching somebody, but keeping them from driving in the first place. If you refuse now, you face a one-year suspension of your license, but within about 30 days, you can get a hardship license or a work license. And so most people just, it's a minor inconvenience, and then they're able to get a license to drive. There are a few exceptions to that. I know the Portland Police Bureau and an officer there has refused to take a breath test in an off-duty incident. The chief of police would not allow them to seek a hardship license and just told them tough luck and made them wait for the entire year before they could drive again. I'll just be brief in this, but I think this is the companion bill requiring people to send an acknowledgement about not drinking and driving when they get their license will take us, the state of Oregon, another step forward in preventing these useless, needless deaths of innocent victims. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barker. Are there questions for the Pratts or Representative Barker? Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Next up, Doug Harkle Road, David
Bill.
Why don't we just hold right there, because I've got two more witnesses after that, and we'll just make it the two of you. So you'd both come forward. Mr. Harkle Road, you're getting to be a regular in our committee. We enjoy seeing you so often.
Happy to be here.
Are you going to lead off, or are we going to hear from Mr. Bill first?
Mr. Bill's the expert.
All right, Mr. Bill, please.
Chairman Williams, members of the committee, I'm David Bill with the Wayne County DA's office. I've been a prosecutor for 12 years. The previous presenters have already made some pretty good arguments why I think this legislation should pass. I'm going to give you five quick points on why I think it should pass also. First of all, the breath test is usually the most important piece of evidence for prosecutors, judges, and juries to determine when someone has been driving under the influence of alcohol. Right now, the way things are, and I think Mr. Brzozinski knows this being a prosecutor, when you get an intake, you got to determine if someone was under the influence when they refuse a breath test. And sometimes it's not clear. And something a lot of us worry about is, one, that we might prosecute someone that shouldn't be prosecuted, and then what happens more often is someone gets away with driving under the influence because they've refused the breath test, either because we don't think there's enough proof and we don't file the charge, or we proceed to trial and lose. The second reason I'd like to bring up is we just need to do everything we can to save lives and prevent serious injuries to people, and this bill goes in that direction. The third point I'd like to address is this should raise a substantial amount of money. In 2002, there were 3,000 suspensions for refusing the breath test. That could raise up to $3 million and should raise at least $1.5 million. Fourth, this bill should save money because when people refuse the breath test, litigation is more likely, diversion is less likely, and change of pleas are less likely, so it costs more money to the courts. And then fifth, this does not affect the suspect's right, because the person does not have a right to refuse a breath test when an officer has probable cause. That's all I have.
Mr. Harkleroad?
Doug Harkleroad, Lane County District Attorney. Mr. Bill didn't tell you that he is an expert in prosecuting vehicle crash cases as well as driving under the influence cases, but he's been doing that for a number of years very successfully. My purpose is to tell you that the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports this bill. That's all I have.
Thank you. I'll ask a note that one of my colleagues who had to leave for another meeting passed me that just posed the question, because this allows a fine, a flexible fine, $500 to $1,000. Why would we not simply schedule it as an A through D violation, or pick the one we want? A violation is at $600, which is within the range that we're talking about here, down to a D of 75. I don't think anybody wanted to be a D. But just the rationale, and I guess since you guys spend your life prosecuting those, would it be easier for us to tag an amount, call it an A violation at a $600 fine, or call it an A violation at a greater amount of the fine, but pick in the tag an amount, as opposed to allow sort of this flexibility within the bill, and what's going to determine when it, how a court decides whether he, you know, whether or the officer who writes the violation, who's going to pick the amount of that violation in the range. You want to, Mr. Wilson?
The answer to that would be,
since you're the expert, we want to hear from the expert, not the not the other guy.
The answer would be the judge. The judge would have the discretion. It would be a lot like possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, where the fine is $500 to $1,000. So if the judge thought there were aggravating factors, they could give the $1,000 fine. If they thought there were more mitigating factors, they could give the $500 fine, or somewhere within that range. The reason we wanted the $500 minimum fine is we do want to raise money for the state of Oregon, and we do think these people as a class are people that can pay money, so we want it to at least be $500. But in some cases, when it's very aggravated, a $1,000 fine does seem appropriate.
Okay. Okay. I'm just wondering, for ease of administration, if it wouldn't sometimes just be easier to tag fine. But it sounds like you like the flexibility.
It seems worthwhile to us to give the judges that flexibility. And it seems like the less than an ounce statute, you can't have unclassified violations where you have a range of 500 to 1,000.
Anything to add, Doug?
No.
Okay, Representative Crum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, kind of following up a little bit on the fine and the fact that the monies collected would go to the Oregon State Police account. Does this this doesn't get us into any kind of a situation, does it, where we start having quotas or start any kind of an abuse of power? Does it?
I hope not. I mean, I don't know why it should.
Yeah, their answer is I don't think so, because practically speaking, what happens is you're now at the intoxilizer room, and they're going to read them the implied consent right. The officer's going to read those to the suspect, and then the suspect is going to say, yes, I'm going to take the test, or no, I'm not. And so if they don't do it, they're going to get a ticket for it. And they're going to get told about the ticket in advance. If you don't do it, you're going to get a ticket. So I don't see that as an abuse of power issue there. They're either going to write it or they're not.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Brzezinski.
If I can just follow up on that for Representative Crimmel, the point where they're in the intoxilizer room, they've already been arrested. The person is not requested to take it. There's no field test out in the actual location where the vehicle stop would be. So they will have already been arrested for being under the influence of intoxicants, and it's the next stage where this would actually occur. But if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just maybe get some comment. The Section 6, which says that all fines collected as a result of a citation issued by a member of the state police is going to go into the special account. So the other fines that are coming from other jurisdictions, are they going to just, I assume, be distributed based on what's in Section 5 of the bill, starting on page 4, just be distributed generally? And if so, why the difference treatment for OSP versus Eugene Police Department, Lane County Sheriffs, or anyone else?
That's actually not a part of the... That's a part of the bill I wasn't a part of putting together, so I don't really know a lot about the distribution of monies. I know when we started talking about this bill, the idea wasn't to designate it, so I think we have to defer to someone else, because I don't know about this part.
And maybe I can shed a little light on that. Don Phillips again, Chair Williams and Representative Brzezinski. Given our current budget environment, we saw an opportunity here. We said, look, this isn't just piling on more laws and bringing more bad guys into the jails, the extra expense that we're going to have to figure out how to pay for later. We saw this as a way to perhaps pay for some of the programs that we already have out there that do DUII enforcement. And in a minute, you're going to hear from the top guys at OSP who do handle this area. And so you're right, Representative Brzezinski. In Section 5, you will see where, under the current statute, it is split up among the agencies that do the arrest. So if it's the Lane County Sheriff's Office and they do the fine for refusing to take the breathalyzer, they would get that portion of the money. But I would argue that it is beneficial to have the state police get a designated fund here, and you'll hear from a minute from the folks from the state police, because they do a lot of the intoxilizer maintenance of the equipment for statewide for all these other agencies. And there are some other things that they cover that local agencies don't, and so I think it's appropriate that we do have a designated fund within state police for this cause.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Why don't we go ahead now and bring up Captain Chuck Hayes and Jeff Ross from the Oregon State Police.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Captain Chuck Hayes, the director of the Oregon State Police Patrol Services Division. I can be fairly brief because most of the things we are going to cover have been covered quite well. The state police is in favor of this bill, and the reason that we are in favor of this is, again, anything that can deter impaired driving, save lives, reduce injuries, we are in favor of that, making our highways safer. I should add also that In my 29 years of law enforcement with the Oregon State Police, I know that it can be quite frustrating at times when you're trying to make an arrest and you're trying to build that case so that it can be prosecuted, that people refuse the breath test. And so this may give us a little bit of leverage there that we could actually be able to collect that evidence. Unfortunately, in my career, the majority of the times that I've had people refuse to give a breath test is the repeat offenders, people that have been arrested 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 times. And so by not having this evidence, it can be very difficult to convict these people. It also gives us a good handle when we have a breath test of someone who's arrested for driving under the influence to know that what that breath test is for and or how much it is. We have seen people, again, that may be suffering from some medical condition and they're suspected of being under the influence of alcohol or an intoxicant, and that breath test can give us some sort of indicator as to whether or not that person should even be charged. It would also lead us to believe if it could be another substance other than alcohol that could be causing that impairment. Could be drugs or some over-the-counter type of medication. And then also it helps us as far as treatment. We have seen some pretty high blood alcohol levels through the years of people that have been arrested. Yet if we do not know what that blood alcohol level is, then we may need to get them some sort of special medical attention or medical care and not just put them behind bars for the night and leave them. So these are all things, again, that helps us when we're trying to make these determinations by having that blood alcohol level. With the Oregon State Police being mentioned in here in Section 6 about receiving the funds for this, well, definitely I'm supportive of that. We know what our budget situation is like, and any time that we can use it for enforcement efforts or efforts to support Jeff's position here within the implied consent, which he's going to talk about that, we're in favor of that, where we can put additional people out on the road to do impaired driving enforcement. One of the other areas, too, that I think is important, the Oregon State Police has been trying for years and years, and it's a goal of mine as a director of the Patrol Services Division, that we have video cameras in every one of our patrol cars so that when you do encounter someone at roadside and you're trying to make that case and collect that evidence, well, then you have that on videotape, because that keeps officers from going to court, a lot of extra money not being spent because of the prosecution and the adjudicating of that suspect. So we could look at funds from that also that would help us support and put that type of equipment in our patrol cars and train our officers to do even a better job of detecting impaired drivers. I've asked Jeff Ross from our implied consent program to come and talk, because he's in a unique position where he is trying to support the intoxilizers that are throughout the state and provide that scientific testimony. So with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Jeff.
Please.
Go ahead.
Mr. Ross, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you, Captain Hayes. For the record, my name is Jeff Rost. I'm the director of the Oregon State Police Implied Consent Program, which is part of the Forensic Services Division. And I prepared some written testimony here for you today that I can hand out, but I'll just kind of paraphrase. The position that I hold is actually the directorship of the program that is responsible for providing all of the breath testing instrumentation to law enforcement in the state. And so we, as a function of the program that I supervise, provide all of the instrumentation that is currently located in the field for all of law enforcement to use in the enforcement of DUI statutes. Not to spend too much time on the budgetary woes of this biennium, but prior to February 1st, I had a staff of 8 FTE assigned to that program. I now have a staff of 2. And we are now, with those same 2 people, attempting to maintain the same 130 instruments in the field that are in fixed locations and the 50 instruments that are out there in portable locations located somewhere around the state. I do not expect that we are going to be able to accomplish that in our current state. And so if things are to continue, it's very possible that at this time next year, somewhere on the order of one half of that instrumentation is going to be out of service, simply because we can't get to it, we can't repair it. We should be able to maintain it for purposes of certification in court, but simply I don't have the repair staff to keep that instrumentation up and running for an extended period of time. So certainly, from my perspective, I'm in support of a bill that potentially could provide a revenue source for us to continue to provide that support to all of law enforcement in the state by continuing to provide breath testing instrumentation around the state. In addition to that, I think that indirectly enhances
the patrol services that we have in the state by allowing our law enforcement officers to stay on the road. Just as an example, let me talk briefly about Lane County that has 10 different breath testing instruments located in that county, one of which is located in Oak Ridge, one of which is located in Florence. Those two locations are easily 45 minutes to an hour and a half from Lane County Jail, which would be the secondary site to those various locations. So in the event that we have an instrument that goes down in one of those two remote locations, the previous two and a half hour DUI arrest just became a 4 or 5 hour DUI arrest every time that an arrest is made, because they're now having to transport that individual to a secondary site. So it's my hopes that we're able to keep that instrumentation up and running in the long term through revenues that would be allocated potentially through bills like this one. That's all I have to say, so I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ross. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's all the witnesses who signed up for that bill. Let me tell you the one thought I had as we were hearing the testimony about the Dedicated Funds Committee, and because Representative Miller was out of town today and not able to be here to present, I wanted to discuss it with him. Typically, when a bill is designating or categorizing revenues to a particular fund, it requires that we send the bill to the Ways and Means Committee for establishment of that fund. I'd like to talk to Representative Miller about that. Obviously, him being the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, that gives him control of his own bill, but before we take action on the bill, I'd like to have that conversation with him in advance to assure that we're thinking about that issue in an appropriate manner. So with that, I'm going to close. Representative Shetterly.
Well, just one question maybe for staff, and idle thought perhaps, and I don't do either criminal or constitutional law, but is there a limit even within the implied consent law beyond which the state cannot go in compelling someone to give evidence against themselves or to basically offer testimony against themselves?
And you're hitting Mr. Joseph, who's actually covering the bill today for Mr. Prinz, because
okay.
He doesn't do criminal law either.
Okay.
Representative Shetterly, it was my hope that one of the persons who were going to address the committee was going to speak on that, and I specifically asked that they do so, but the question obviously didn't come up.
We can't find someone for not confessing, for instance.
Right. It's my understanding under the current law, if you read the section that's being amended, you can bring into court the fact that they refused a breath test as evidence against them, which obviously goes farther than one would think under the Fifth Amendment. However, we are dealing with physical evidence or conduct here, not necessarily speech.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a question, I believe, as to whether we could go farther and fine the person for refusing to take the test. But it's my understanding that a number of other states have this law. I'm not sure whether those have been tested in the courts, but I assume some of them have.
And Representative Shetterly, we have successfully allowed it as a basis for suspension.
Right.
Recognizing
yeah.
that that's a bit of a different relationship because of the privileged nature of
right.
the driving right. But it's an interesting point.
Just a question.
One that maybe some of the people who have testified could respond to the representative before we bring the bill back to work session. Anything else? With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2900. We'll open the hearing on House Bill 2901 and ask Barbara Stoeffler and the Pratts to come forward again. And I would just indicate to you that we're going to lose our quorum here in probably about 10 minutes. We apologize that we got a late start because the floor session went long today. And just ask that you be flexible with it, but we probably need to try to expedite the testimony this afternoon. Please begin.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, again, I'm Ann Pratt from Lane County, a member of Crime Victims United, MAD, and POMC, and a secondary victim of a DUI fatality. We're here today to ask you to pass House Bill 2901. We believe we are not doing enough to deter drunk driving. We are asking that each licensed driver in the state of Oregon sign an acknowledgement and an agreement stating that driving in Oregon is a privilege and acknowledging that driving under the influence of intoxicants can result in serious injury and death. It is an agreement, and it also describes what could possibly happen to them. It is an agreement not to drive under the influence of intoxicants. We're asking for a separate signature line, lettering to be bold in red ink, copies to be kept on file by DMV, to be placed on new and renewed driver's license applications and vehicle registration applications. I believe this is a simple statement that would serve as a very bold and binding reminder that each and every one of us is responsible. Driving in Oregon is a privilege, not a right. Alcohol plays a very large part in the American culture, and I believe sometimes we may all be looking the other way when it comes to the intoxicated driver. I don't believe there's a person in this room who couldn't tell me a story about someone they knew or about someone who was killed by an intoxicated driver. And it is estimated that 3 out of 10 of us will actually encounter one ourselves. I would never want to minimize the 911 tragedy. It was horrible. Many lives were lost, but well over 17,000 people die across America in alcohol and drug-related crashes each year. Approximately 200 last year were killed in Oregon, and 2,000 were injured. This is unacceptable. Mental health providers and law enforcement indicate that they are seeing evidence that more people are self-medicating, meaning alcohol and drugs, due to the economy and the 911 attacks. We need to do better in these times. This is not only a criminal problem, it is a problem deeply rooted within our society by our tolerant views of driving under the influence. These are some of the excuses I've heard before and after my son was killed. It couldn't happen to me, or it was just an accident, or he or she wasn't in his right mind, or maybe he or she shouldn't have been there. These are excuses, plain and simple. And I believe that we all need to take more responsibility. Crime Victims United, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, and the ODAA support this bill. Matt has asked me to read this following statement. The idea to include a don't drink and drive message on driver's license and registration applications in the state of Oregon is an appropriate and needed message. MAD will support this legislative concept. This agreement and acknowledgement will serve as a warning, an educational tool, and a reminder, and hopefully would save some lives. And I believe that asking drivers to sign this very personal, direct reminder is not too much to ask when taking on the responsibility of careening down the highway behind the wheel of 300 pounds of steel. Thank you for this opportunity. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Pratt.
Members of the committee, my name is Bruce Pratt from Lane County. My wife has so eloquently stated most of what I had to say, so I'll shorten mine. 98% of the driving public see drinking and driving as a threat to their personal safety, according to Mothers Against Drunk Driving. It has been estimated that a person convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants has driven drunk 200 to 2,000 times before being arrested. The average alcohol-related fatality in Oregon costs society $3.5 million, and each injury is $108,000. The main value of this statement to be added to the applications is that everyone will receive another reminder of the dangers of, as my dad used to say, mixing alcohol and gasoline. I believe that each and every one of us should be required to sign this statement. We must do everything that we can to stop the carnage on our highway. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Stoffler?
Thank you very much, Representative Williams and members of the committee. I'm Barbara Steffler. I'm a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I was also a member of the Governor's Task Force on DUII in 1983 when we came to this session and worked so hard. And the following years when we finally, when it was turned or changed, name changed into the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, I served the following 12 years. I want to thank this committee in particular because of the work and the role you played in all of the drunk driving bills that have been passed from 1983 until this day. I think the bills today make a lot of sense. I've watched over the course of the years how it's made a difference in the state of Oregon, but we still have a long way to go, and this is why. Things have changed in the state of Oregon. We now have a lot of immigrants coming in that they don't understand, particularly the drunk driving laws for the state of Oregon. I serve or and supervise the victim impact panel down in Eugene, Oregon. And what we're seeing and what we have to do is we hire an interpreter every single month for these people. But we have a large percentage of Spanish folks who come to the victim impact panel presentations. They cannot understand English. They don't understand our culture, and they're drinking and driving. We need to have something that reinforces their need, their understanding of our laws in the state of Oregon. I think the responsibility that everyone takes needs to be reinforced, and they can do that by signing this acknowledgement. The other is our youth. Well, we always have new youth coming, and that's an important segment of our population. As they grow up, they want driver's licenses. It won't hurt, and it might help to have them sign a pledge. Well, all of us need to. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for either the Pratts or Ms. Steffler? Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you. For the Pratts, Bruce, you made comments which I hadn't heard before about wanting these to be actually retained, these records to be retained by the Department of Transport, DMV. Has there been some discussion as to what the length of retention would be and what potential cost that might be? I mean, one of the concerns I would have is whether we're adding some cost to state government that has not been contemplated that may send it to Ways and Means. And the purpose for retaining the records?
Actually, I believe that I said it, Representative Prozanski. No, we don't have an estimate of how much that would cost. We have not looked into that.
Did you have a Representative, I'll just mention that Kelly Taylor is here from ODOT, and she has signed up on the list.
Oh,
so
yeah,
that's
that.
That's probably a better question to put to Kelly when she comes up.
One last question. Besides the giving the acknowledgement, which we discussed as to these individuals, was there a decision to want these records to be able to be used in a civil proceeding or anything, any type of civil litigation as well?
We hadn't. That wasn't our intention.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Janet Lovelace.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, I won't take long here. I did have a prepared statement, and I will submit that to you. I also have a written statement on House Bill 2900. If I can just shorten this up here, I am in support of House Bill 2901. This bill is one of several in the steps of re-educating the public regarding the dangers of driving under the influence of intoxicants. It is, for the long haul, it is one piece of the puzzle that must be followed through. As Barb Steffler stated, she has been working for many years, put in many years of time and effort to get laws passed, And I believe that House Bill 2901 is just that, another piece to that. It is something that is a reminder. It's going to send a clear message to the new drivers. It's going to send messages to those who renew their licenses that drinking and driving do not go together. Slowly, and I mean slowly, over time, more and more people will think before they drink. House Bill 2901 is a reminder of your responsibility as a driver. House Bill 2901 also is just a step in the process of this change of this in order to save lives. Drinking and driving kills. Think before you drink. Plan ahead. It is your responsibility as elected officials to ensure that strict laws are in place to correctly assign punishment for those who choose to live outside of society's expected behavior. In June of 2000, my 12-year-old daughter was killed by a hit-and-run driver, a man who admittedly drank alcohol the evening of the homicide. Of course, he did leave the scene, so there was no BAC testing on him. But I thought about the question, would the passage of this bill, if it had House Bill 2901 been law before June 9th of 2000, would that have saved my daughter's life? No one can answer that. So to me, the passage of this bill is just, again, a tool, an educational step in getting these drivers off the road, that are intoxicated, and that just to educate each and every driver that drinking and driving do not go together. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming down, Ms. Lovelace, and to give us your testimony. Are there questions? And we'll take, if you want to just give your testimony to the committee assistant, we'll put that on the record.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Finally, again, Mr. Harkleroad, David Bill, and Kelly Taylor from ODOT. If all three of you could come up together, this will be the concluding panel on the bill. And it is my usual practice, I'll defer to Mr. Harkleroad first, and then he can tell me that Mr. Bill is the expert on the subject. Doug, do you want to lead off?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Williams. Members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkleroad, again for the record, the Lane County District Attorney, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and the Oregon District Attorneys Association does endorse this bill. At least Mr. Prozanski, maybe others know that I am the victim of a drunk driver, and I'm pleased to report that I'm a survivor. My view on this statement on the before you get a driver's license is that this continues the push that the Mothers Against Drunk Drivers started so long ago to change the attitudes in our country, in our state, that it's not okay to drink and drive. And this is a personal statement that everybody in the state of Oregon who applies for a driver's license will have to sign and say that, in essence, it's not okay to drink and drive. It's a powerful statement. When you read it, many people will go through the application quickly. But I'd suggest that you pass this and you tell Oregon drivers that the state of Oregon says it is a privilege to drive your automobile here and you don't get to do it drunk. And if you do it, you know that you can hurt people. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Harbrook. Mr. Bill?
You said it so well, I can't really add to that. Other than some of the people I've prosecuted in homicide cases and their defense attorneys tell me this, is the defense attorneys claim that their client didn't understand the risk of drinking and driving, that it could kill people and seriously injure them. And whether that's just the defense attorney saying things to me or that's really what their client's telling them, I don't know. But after meeting with some of these defendants, it seems like they maybe don't get it. You know, maybe when they decided to drink and drive, if they had read something like this before, maybe they wouldn't have done what they did, and maybe we'd have some people alive that are dead now. So that's why I'm urging you to pass this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Bill. Kelly?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. I just wanted to
give the committee information on the fiscal impact of the bill. The sheer volume of transactions that this bill touches, all vehicle renewals, registration renewals and originals, driver license originals renewals, is about 4.5 million transactions in a biennium. And so just the sheer volume of that adds up. We've estimated the fiscal impact to be over 500,000 in the first biennium and close to 700,000 in the second biennium. It's about 8 additional positions we would need. And this is a very conservative estimate looking at, you know, less than a minute to fill out the additional information, 10 seconds to explain it to half of the people who want more information. I mean, it's based on what we've gone through with other bills when we've had to implement new requirements with licensing. So we've gotten a fairly good handle on what it takes out in the field office to do this. So it is a substantial fiscal impact for us. I just wanted you to know that and why, because it's just sheer volume.
Thank you, Representative Brzezinski.
Kelly, could you just follow up on the question I had? One of the questions I asked was about civil, because if we're looking to use this potentially in a civil liability suit, then there's going to be a duration of time that they would need to be stored. Your estimates, is this just processing the documents, or is this storage of those? Or what process is used now on just a standard application that's now being filed for DM?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brzezinski, and after you asked that, I looked through to see the documentation. It does include the microfilming of the documents.
It does?
It does. It does not include pulling the documents off of microfilm for any court cases. That would be additional cost, and those would have to be paid for by the prosecutor or the court or whoever is ordering those documents.
Okay, are there further questions, Representative Barker?
I'm sorry, what was the number again? How much is that going to cost?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, about $534,000 in the first biennium and $689,000 roughly in the second biennium. And that's 8 additional positions.
Mr. Chair? Representative Sherwin.
I'm sorry, I had to step out. Why would we need this for a prosecution? I mean, if it's against the law, it's against the law. We don't need anyone to acknowledge this against the law. Why would we need these for prosecution purposes?
If I may, I had asked the question earlier if this was intended to be used potentially in a civil suit where someone is actually signed and acknowledging that they knew that they were wrong and that there's a question of retaining the records, and I'm just trying to get clarity as to exactly what that entails.
And I'm not sure whether Mr. Ville would want to comment. It does seem to me that if you were prosecuting one of these cases and a person, you know, was sort of continuing to assert that they just didn't understand the consequences of their actions.
Ignorance is no defense?
Well, it isn't, but it might be persuasive to a jury to have a big blow-up of the back of the form that they signed. I don't know whether or not it would ever be in your intent to use it, but, I mean, I certainly would think I would want to use it if I was prosecuting. Mr. Ville?
That's correct. And one of the elements in any reckless assault or reckless homicide is you have to be aware of the risk and then disregard it. So this would be evidence that they were at one point in time aware of the risk and that they disregarded it. The defense could always argue that they forgot, but it would be persuasive,
sure,
that at least at one point,
sure,
in time they understood that risk.
Anything else? Again, given the fact that Representative Miller is gone, it's going to be my intention not to take this bill into work session today, but give him an opportunity to discuss with the various agencies the fiscal and have us come to some determination about what we want to do after that. But we do appreciate all of your testimony and your patience with us today as we were late in starting. So with that, I'll close House Bill 2901, the public hearing, and adjourn the committee. Thank you. Oh, all right. Take it back. We're going to recess. Tomorrow night is our last night.
Tomorrow.
It's not tonight.
No,
it's not
wrong.
It's Tuesday.
Tuesday night.
Last week it was Monday.
It was, but we switched over to Tuesday.
Changed it on us.
You guys keep up. We're adjourned. Next 2 Tuesdays.